Good afternoon. I'm Tom Getty, past chair of the Criminal Law Practice Group of the Federalist Society. And it's a great personal privilege for me to introduce our luncheon speaker today. This is not going to be the Wikipedia introduction. Governor Wilson is well known to you for his service in the California State Assembly as mayor of San Diego, twice elected as a United States Senator, serving from January 1983 to January 1991, and as the two-term governor of California. His distinguished career included service as a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, where he called for the early implementation of President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative. He has served as an advisor to the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board and on President Bush's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. As the 36th governor of California from January 1991 to January 1999, he enacted reforms in education, energy, healthcare, and criminal law, and appointed first-rate judges like Janice Rogers Brown, Dan Kolke, and Connie Callahan. But notwithstanding his strong credentials as a fiscal conservative, as strong on national defense senator, and as a governor whose leadership left the state with a $16 billion budget surplus, he is generally remembered by the media and certain progressive circles for one issue and one issue only: immigration. And one word seems to appear in all the reports: vilify. I'm serious. Look at Google and put Wilson and vilify, and you'll see Wilson vilified by and Wilson vilifies X. The mainstream media, if we can use that charged term, I do, routinely report that Governor Wilson is vilified by the immigrant community for his stance against immigrants. Of course, they do not distinguish between legal immigrants and illegal immigrants. The political left and the defenders of uncontrolled immigration, of course, are generally busy vilifying Pete Wilson for his policies against undocumented workers, the politically correct term. Language is important here. Even the most sympathetic media liken him somewhat to Captain Flint, you know, good on the inside, but Pirate of the Caribbean, bad on the outside. The LA Times has noted that Pete Wilson generally has been vilified, again, vilified, as a tight-fisted, cold-hearted curmudgeon. This apparently goes beyond the issue of immigration. So political pundits repeat mantra-like their conviction that the Republican Party in California went into decline because the Hispanic vote was alienated by Pete Wilson, who forever tainted GOP politics in the Golden State because of his hostility to immigrants. Again, a distinction is never made between legal and illegal immigrants. Well, we have come full circle now that the issue is front and center before the nation. Every candidate for president of the United States on the platform is asked, and he or she answers with a clear distinction between legal immigrants and illegal immigrants, as if no one ever made that point before. I fully expect the candidates all to say, "Where is Pete Wilson when we need him?" Well, he is here. He is still here. And he can say, "I told you so," with more authority than anybody else in the political arena. He's a Marine, so he can do a lot of things with authority. If he is a tight-fisted, cold-hearted curmudgeon, he is my favorite tight-fisted, cold-hearted curmudgeon. In truth, he is a leader with a heart, and with the intelligence and wisdom to guide us all. I am hugely proud to be his colleague, his law partner, and his friend. Together with his beautiful, smart, and charming wife, Gail, they illuminate the room and inform us with insight, wisdom, and grace. Please give a warm welcome, Semper Fi, to Governor Pete Wilson.
Are there any questions? Tom, thank you. That was more than generous. I am delighted to have this opportunity. I was delighted when it was extended The invitation was extended, and even more delighted when I learned that this was the venue. I spend a good bit of time out here. I have the privilege of serving on the Board of Trustees for the Reagan Library. So it occurred to me today that perhaps I might begin with a little story. I had the good fortune as a young legislator to be the Republican whip in the Assembly when Ronald Reagan was governor. Later, I had the good fortune as the junior senator from California to serve under President Reagan for 6 of his 8 years in the Oval Office. And I think you know all there is to know about him from Wikipedia. What you may not know, although I think he was famous for it, is that he was a remarkably entertaining raconteur. He knew more jokes and could tell them better than anyone I have ever met. And he had a favorite. Some of you may be aware of what it is. It involves the anxious father of 5-year-old twin boys who, while identical, had totally disparate personalities. One was a hearty extrovert and full of an ebullient zest for life. Everything, every day, he greeted with enthusiasm. His brother, by contrast, was a sad child, morose, never smiled, and it became, as they grew older, a source of great anxiety to their father, to the point where he visited a psychiatrist to seek counsel. And as he described this situation, the psychiatrist said, "I think I need to have a look at both these boys." He did, and he called, and he said to the father, he said, "Well, you're absolutely right. One of these children is a hopeless pessimist, and the other an equally irrational optimist, and therefore I think the situation is so stark, so grave, that we need to employ a shock technique to bring them both to reality." So he said, "I propose this. Christmas is coming up about a month from now." He said, "I suggest that you buy wondrous toys for the pessimist and put those in one room in your house on Christmas Eve after they've gone to bed, and in another room in the house. This will shock you, but I think you need to actually load it with horse manure." And the father said, "Oh my God, that's terrible. I can't do that." And he said, "It is necessary. There has to be a shock." Christmas morning came, and the father went first to the room full of the wondrous toys. And the little boy looked at them, and he said, "Well, yeah, it's a nice drum, but," he said, "I bet it'll break first time I play it." And his father said, "Well, how do you like the bike?" And he said, "Well, it's okay, but, you know, my pants will get caught in the chain, and I'll fall off and probably break my arm." This was too much. The father just was in despair. All of a sudden, he was distracted by the whooping and hollering, the laughter, the joy coming from the other room where the other twin was in with the horse manure. So the father walked down there, opened the door, and here is this kid just throwing it by both shoulders. And he said, "Come on, Dad, help me. There's got to be a pony in here somewhere." I tell you that because that was, I think, the president's favorite joke. Now, as you've been led to believe, I'm going to talk to you today about immigration. I will leave it to you to determine whether I am an optimist or a pessimist. I'm going to begin by talking about how the states have been increasingly ignored mostly by the acts and omissions of both Congress and the executive branch, and certainly by this president, and largely by the courts. The states continue to feel the heavy impacts and the very high costs of federal failure to deal rationally and adequately with immigration policy. Now, having been a state chief executive and a federal legislator, I come to the subject with long experience and some very strong views. Less than 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court of the United States granted certiorari in United States v. Texas, a case in which 26 states have challenged the Obama administration's, quote, deferral, close quote, of deportation that would allow 4 million illegal immigrants to remain in this country for at least 3 years. The president, acting unilaterally without approval of Congress, has sponsored two categories of illegal immigrants whom he would make eligible for such deferral. One of these groups he calls Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, and the other Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. What is his rationale for conferring immunity upon persons otherwise subject to deportation? Or to put it in other words, what empowers him to suspend federal law and change the status of people who have broken the law by entering the country illegally? He claims that he is exercising his prosecutorial discretion. Prosecutorial discretion. The federal district court in Texas halted his program, and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the district court ruling. It occurred to me that maybe the jurists felt that exempting a class of 4 million people stretched the concept of prosecutorial discretion a bit too far. And of course, if that doesn't work for him, you can always try to pardon them. But of course, if he is successful, his exercise of prosecutorial discretion will trigger greatly expanded entitlement to benefits and services, with the impact and the increased costs falling hard upon the states. I frankly wish the Supreme Court had denied cert, but they didn't. One very heartening development, though, is that the High Court, urged by the states against the wishes of the administration, expanded its scope of review to include the question of whether the president's exercise of discretion fulfills his duty to, quote, take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Now, at the same time, the court will review whether the states have standing to bring suit. Texas argued that the policy would force it, among other things, to issue driver's licenses and provide other benefits to unlawful immigrants at the expense of the state's taxpayers, the action being caused not by the state, but by an unlawful federal change in immigration status and by the federal failure to control the border against illegal entry. Now, what troubles me is that the court will be looking at the state's position in the current Texas case in light of the recent precedent, 2012, reaffirming federal primacy over immigration policy. In 2012, the court overturned much of an Arizona law, Senate Bill 1070, that made it a crime to be lawfully present in the United States, and it authorized warrantless arrests of suspect illegal aliens. Now, that case troubles me now as I look forward to what the court will do in the present Obama deportation case. In the Arizona case, the court embraced such an expansive view of the federal government's authority in immigration and naturalization, that it virtually ruled out all state authority in this area, even when the states mimicked the federal law precisely. And again, when it is the states that inevitably suffer the impact of federal failure to control the border. Somehow, I don't think this would be Madison's vision of shared government authority. In Arizona, the court mechanically relied upon principles of federal, upon principles of federal preemption, which certainly are applicable when federal and state laws conflict. But here, where the laws did not conflict, the court nonetheless determined that even complementary state action to regulate it is impermissible because the federal government has occupied the field. Justice Kennedy authored the opinion against Arizona's exercise of state authority. He was joined by three liberal justices, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor. Justice Kagan recused herself. But also joining and making a five-member majority against the state of Arizona was Chief Justice John Roberts, who perhaps, well, just coincidentally, had been involved in defeating another challenge by some 26 states in the case of Obamacare. But the participation of Chief Justice Roberts in the majority opinion in Arizona in 2012 tells me that he accords great deference to federal preemption and finds state involvement in immigration matters inappropriate. So what happens when the court hears the Texas case in 2016? If, predictably, the four liberal justices find that the states do not have standing to challenge the Obama deferral of deportation, will Chief Justice Roberts join them? Will he once again deny to the states any voice in immigration matters that fall so heavily upon them? To put this question in perspective, let me take you back in time, not to the days of Hamilton and Madison, but just to 1982. In June of that year, the United States Supreme Court decided the case of Plyler v. Doe, striking down a Texas statute that prohibited state funding for K through 14 education for illegal immigrants. Justice Brennan, offering the opinion, joined by Justices Marshall, Blackmun, Powell, and Stevens, could not find that saving Texas taxpayers from the extraordinary expense of educating illegal immigrant children was a substantial state interest, and thus they found that it failed the intermediate scrutiny standard required to avoid discrimination under the 14th Amendment. The dissent by Chief Justice Berger didn't find it so difficult. They found that it did. More than a decade after Plyler was decided, California voters, as you have heard from Tom, faced much the same important policy question. Should state funds be prohibited from being spent for non-emergency health care, public education, and social services for illegal immigrants? The question was put to California voters on the November 1994 ballot in the form of Proposition 187. And if you were here then, you will recall that it passed overwhelmingly by almost 60% of the vote. Now, at the time, it was estimated that California had almost 1.3 million illegal immigrants. That was an official estimate. The unofficial was that it was nearer to 2 million. But in any case, what was clear was that it included more than 300,000 illegal immigrant children. The fiscal impact of providing health care, education, and incarceration of alien felons in combination amounted to more than $3 billion, or 7% of the entire state operating budget. Indeed, one of the reasons compelling my strong support for 187 was the Plyler case that had been heard and decided 10 years before 187 was on the ballot. Plyler was a weak 5-4 Brennan opinion. I was convinced that if we could get 187 before a notably less liberal Supreme Court a decade later, there was a good chance that the court would overturn Plyler. And I knew that if 187 passed, it would face legal challenge, and I was determined to pursue appeal all the way to the Supreme Court. But it never got there. The people of California were cheated of their day in the Supreme Court. One of the most dishonest fictions persistently put forth then and now by liberal media and other opponents of 187 is the claim that it was found unconstitutional and was, quote, thrown out by the courts. That is not true. The courts did not throw it out. What is true is that despite the fact that only legal issues were at stake, Federal District Court Judge Mariana Felser allowed the case to languish in her court, inexcusably, I think, for 3 years. And when she finally released an opinion, only 1 year remained left in my last term. And of course, I promptly appealed to the Ninth Circuit. No other court ever got the chance to rule on Proposition 187 or to reconsider the Plyler case. Rather, the Ninth Circuit permitted a disposition of my appeal by my successor, Governor Davis, who engaged in, frankly, a sham mediation in which he and the respondents were very clearly on the same side, opposed to 187. Before, during, and after his campaign for governor, Gray had said that though he personally deplored 187 and had voted against it, he would nonetheless honor the will of the people. And although the opponents of 187 persist in this dishonesty right to this day, the matter remains unresolved because Plyler remains a Supreme Court precedent that continues to subject state taxpayers to the burden of subsidizing liberal federal irresponsibility. It needs to be overturned. But my concern, my fear, frankly, after Chief Justice Roberts' vote for federal preemption with Justice Kennedy and the three liberal justices on the Arizona statute, is that when they hear the Texas challenge to Obama's deferral, the same strange five-vote majority may find that the states lack standing to press the substantively infinitely more important issue of the chief executive's failure to take care to faithfully enforce the law. The states have not only a right, but I would argue a duty to see that the question is addressed. And I think even Madison would agree. There needs to be a reexamination by both the courts and Congress of the jurisprudence of the 10th Amendment, and specifically whether the two doctrines of federal commandeering and of coercion under the spending clause are adequate to protect the states against Washington's abuses, especially when it is state taxpayers who get stuck with a very steep bill. Now, I am all for Congress undertaking repair of an immigration system that is badly broken in many respects. Congress is the proper venue for enactment of reform. But having been there, I will tell you, it is a forum rife with human imperfection and demonstrated capacity for delay, infinite delay. Think Harry Reid. We take pride in a system based upon supposed separation of powers. We look to the courts to construe the law, not to make it. But in its determination to avoid the political thicket, the judicial system eagerly finds and then avoids non-justiciable issues that too often render the court of little help in resolving concrete disputes over the power of the federal government. As governor of California, I turned to Proposition 187 to get federal attention. I did so after the courts had proved utterly unresponsive and largely incapable of providing relief for my state and several other states who found the same response. For real ills that my state and so many others suffered at the hands of federal, not very benign neglect, the courts too often offered pat formulations that didn't fit and really offered no relevant response. Let me give you an example. Long before 187 was on the ballot, I initiated a suit against the United States in the name of the people of California, seeking specific performance to secure the border against illegal entry and for reimbursement of the costs imposed by federal mandates requiring the state to fund emergency health care for illegal immigrants, for the costs of incarceration of alien felons, then 1 in 5 in our prison system, today 1 in 4, and for the cost of providing public schooling to illegal immigrant children. We alleged that the United States violated its obligation to protect the state from invasion under the Invasion Clause of Article 4 of the United States Constitution. And as for reimbursement, we demanded the federal government. We alleged violations of the Guarantee Clause, the 10th Amendment, and the existing statutory authority providing for reimbursement of the states. What we ultimately got from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, concluding that our Invasion Clause claim was non-justiciable and must be left to the political branch, the same with the Guarantee Clause claims. It then dismissed the 10th Amendment claim, holding there was no commandeering of the state. As to the health care expenses, well, the court found that the federal mandate to provide health care to illegals was a permissible exercise of the congressional spending power and not commandeering. And as for incarceration of alien felons, well, the Ninth Circuit said those prisoners were imprisoned pursuant to state law. So there was no commandeering there. Got it? California could simply exercise discretion not to prosecute and imprison alien felons and thus not incur the expense. Having made the choice to do so, the state cannot be heard to complain. Well, of course. Just think of the money we could have saved by ignoring the attack on Pearl Harbor. Well, finally, the court relied on good old Plyler v. Doe to explain that California had a duty to spend money on educating illegal immigrant children without reimbursement. Do you see a pattern emerging here? A pattern of federal judicial response enabling and even furthering federal dysfunction of the Congress and the executive branch, all but encouraging continued federal neglect of the border and all the problems that their inattention caused. I understand it would be unfair to equate the performance of all federal courts with that of the Ninth Circuit. I do remember that my first year in office, there was the matter of an execution, and it was a long night for the U.S. Supreme Court because the lights were burning bright in San Francisco with appeals stays being sought until finally the word came down from the Supreme Court that no further requests for stay would be entertained. And it was then I learned that in the past year, the Ninth Circuit had been reversed 28 out of 29 times by the Supreme Court. Now, there are fine jurists on every court, including the Ninth Circuit, and I am glad, however, that the challenge to the president's policy of deferral in United States v. Texas was brought in the Fifth Circuit. Because deferral is something they seem to understand all too well in the Ninth. Anyway, my friends, by now you probably think that you have figured it out, and that I am indeed the pessimist twin. Not so. I wouldn't have chosen politics as a primitive art form for self-expression had I not been an optimist. And I am convinced that there are enough people in this room of wonderfully wholesome instincts about safeguarding the rights of individuals and states. They're not totally divergent. And that there is the wisdom and the expertise in this room to work with Congress and to work with courts to see to it that we don't simply mechanically apply doctrines with the result that justice is not done. And in the case of this serious, serious area of federal responsibility, that's important. Tom made much of the fact that I have been vilified by people who have labeled me anti-immigrant, and that is totally false. Indeed, this nation depends upon legal immigration, and generations of legal immigrants have brought to this country not only drive and energy, but enormous patriotism. But they were legal immigrants who had undergone naturalization. That is what the law prescribes, wisely so, because we used to have even greater variety, but still, e pluribus unum is an appropriate response, a motto for this nation. Legal immigration is a superb thing, not only for the immigrants, but for all the rest of us. Some years ago, some of you will recall that the first serious presidential inquiry into the problems of illegal immigration was under study, with the chairman of that effort being Father Hesper, the revered former president of Notre Dame University. When he made his report of the findings of that group, he wisely counseled, if the United States is to continue enjoying the benefits of legal immigration, it must close the back door of illegal immigration. What he was saying is, if they can cut to the line, why will people who have entered the country illegally take the time and make the effort to undergo naturalization? It was a good question then. It's a good question now. I hope the courts will help the Congress not just take pity on the states, but make the system work as it did for a long, long time and can again. Thank you.
Questions for Governor Wilson? Do we have the microphone? There we go.
Does anybody from the Ninth Circuit want equal time? I hear you, but I don't see you. Oh, yes.
So I know one of your concerns in your talk was about the Supreme Court ruling on standing for the state of Texas. Do you think after Massachusetts versus EPA, do you think that case will have any impact on how this court will analyze the standing inquiry in this case?
I don't know. It's a good question, but I think that the functions are so different that it makes it difficult to predict it. And I think I've indicated that I already have difficulty predicting it. I hope that I'm wrong and that the performance with the Arizona statute doesn't foretell what they will do on this one.
Questions?
Well, that being true, is there a question?
I'm interested just a little bit more on your thoughts on how things will go with immigration and with naturalization if things were to go as you would like them to see go. Do you see that process being fairly smooth? Do you see it being politically very difficult in the world we're in now? What would you see going forward?
I think that it's been instructive somewhat to watch the debates on the Republican side that are currently underway. What has occurred, I think, is that, well, let's go back. I mean, I'm an unabashed admirer of President Reagan. I think one bad decision that he made was the amnesty of 1986. It was predicated upon, I think, frankly, a rather naive assumption that it would be the last. And it has been anything but. The clear history is that it has instead encouraged ongoing massive illegal immigration. And I think that what we have learned from the experience in other places, notably in Israel, notably now in the Middle East and Europe, which is suddenly awash with refugees, and God knows who else, that this problem is one that really does need to be addressed. It is a sensitive problem in every instance. But what is clear is that if you're not going to tolerate ongoing massive illegal entry, then you have to do what the Israelis have done, and that is you have to first have a secure border. And for those who say that's an impossibility, no, I think they've made it quite clear that if you devote sufficient physical barriers, sufficient technology, sensors and other technology, and sufficient manpower, then it is a matter of will. There is a mandate on the books right now for Congress to act. They've never funded it. And many of the people who are in those debates say, we need at least 700 miles of a physical barrier. We need, in addition, the kind of technological detection capability and the kind of manpower to deal with it. And our own experience some years ago on the border in an area that was just a free flow. In fact, enterprising young teenagers were ferrying people across the Rio Grande on rafts in broad daylight. That ended when there were adequate Border Patrol agents actually stopping the process. So it can be done. And by the way, for the critics who say we can't afford it, the cost of construction would be incredible, I would suggest that they really look at what the costs are annually, the recurring costs of failing to secure the border. But the main thing really is by securing the border, what you will do is encourage legal immigration. And for those who are under the delusion that amnesty works, it doesn't. To the contrary, as the experience since the 86 amnesty has shown without a doubt, it encourages the belief on the part of those coming illegally that they can escape the time and the effort necessary for naturalization simply by coming, and that what encourages them the most is the porous borders that exist now, still unsecured, by the way, 15 years after 9/11, and they are encouraged by the belief, the expectation, that there will be another amnesty, and perhaps another, and another. And that is not the way America should grow. We should welcome those immigrants who are willing to come and take the time to come and go through naturalization to learn about what this country stands for. Most of them already know. That's why they come. Yes, ma'am. Yes. One of the least controversial ballot measures that involved race and language was the decision to eliminate bilingual education in the California schools, to eliminate the $5,000 bonus, I think, that was given annually for those who would instruct in the native tongue of the students. That passed pretty handily, and it passed with, as I recall from the exit polls, with at least 50% of Latino voters supporting the end of bilingual education, for the very simple reason that they understood that if their children were ever to be accorded all that they could benefit from in both the commerce and the culture of their adopted land, they'd really have to be fluent in the language. It doesn't even take a generation. If you've got little kids, they'll pick it up like that. And to instead keep them in a native tongue is to deny them full participation, first-class citizenship in the culture and the commerce of the country. It was a smart, good decision. The guy behind it is not a favorite of mine. I give credit where it's due. He did the right thing, and so did the voters. And we, I think, have sharply reduced that. Now, I still, I'm not naive enough to think that doors don't get closed and people don't get taught. But it is, by and large, a very great change and a welcome one. Yes, sir.
Governor, do you think we'll ever have a Republican governor in California? if so, how?
You're compelling me to speculate, but I will begin with a premise that is not speculative. Well, yes, it is. I take that back. Recently, and I say this having been perhaps perceived as somewhat critical of the courts today, let's give credit where it's due to the Supreme Court of the United States. They seem to be headed for the correct decision in a California case, Friedrichs versus CTA. I have strong feelings about that. I submitted an amicus curiae brief, and the court, I think, is headed towards doing the right thing, towards heeding that and a number of other amici. It is an interesting case. If you're not familiar with it, Friedrichs, the plaintiff, is a veteran public school teacher from Orange County. She is an agency fee payer, protesting that, and protesting it essentially as a violation of her First Amendment rights. And what she is saying is that the state law that imposes the requirement, either that you, if you're going to work for the state or for a local government, that you must join a union having jurisdiction of your skills, or if you choose not to, you have to suffer the status of an agency fee payer under the rationale that otherwise you can be a free rider for the collective bargaining that the union is conducting for the members of the union who pays dues. So you wind up as an agency fee payer under existing law, paying roughly the same that you would if you were paying the dues as a dues-paying member of the union. The worst part is that another requirement of state law is that you suffer either as a dues-paying member of the union or as essentially the payer of an agency fee, you suffer making an involuntary political contribution because a very significant portion of that goes to the union, the leader of the union that you didn't want to join in the first place if you're an agency fee payer. And they made another interesting argument, and that is that inherently, as much as they try and bifurcate what is being spent for politics and what is not, that every decision that they make is a political decision, and that there is disagreement, sharp disagreement, I can assure you, on the part of not just these plaintiffs, but a lot of others. And at the hearing about, 2 or 3 weeks ago, the questions from the majority seemed quite hostile to the arguments being made by the government, by the state government and the federal government, Mr. Verrilli, the Solicitor General, and the state Solicitor General, got some very tough questions. Now, I hope that portends a finding and then a decision in favor of the plaintiffs. If that occurs, then I would predict to you that you will see free people making a decision that they've got better things to do than pay $1,000 a year to a union boss who is giving them no say in the political decisions that he is making for them. And when that happens, it will eliminate the enormous financial advantage in this huge state of 13 major media markets that has given the Democrats the huge advantage that they have enjoyed through this several decades now. I was not the last Republican governor, but I won against a very good candidate, two very good candidates, in fact, both women. Kathleen was a much better candidate than Jerry, and I thought I'd driven a stake through his heart in 1982. Yes, we will have another Republican governor, but it's going to take a little while because we haven't seen the opinion yet. I think it's coming. I think it's going to be a good one. And if that change occurs, then history, I think, teaches that in other jurisdictions where they have been freed from the legal imposition to suffer an involuntary political contribution, the participation drops like a rock. Now, that'll make a big difference. It's not all of it. And the other thing that we have to do is we really have to get back to the kind of ground level blocking and tackling that still happens in certain counties, but not in, by any means. When I was a young volunteer in San Diego County, and then for a time was the director of the county committee's efforts, we used to send people as registrars to naturalization ceremonies. And we used to have a desk there and forms that allowed people to register as Republicans. We haven't done that in a while. We need to start it again, just as candidates need to go door to door, ringing doorbells. We need to understand that we are at a disadvantage. I mean, the media, great God. The media are not on our side, although I must admit, after they had spent 2 months in the damnedest media barrage I have ever seen against any issue, the Los Angeles Times, to my absolute shock, endorsed me for re-election in 94. I think the newsroom almost resigned en masse, but the publisher had a lot of moxie. But the point really is the media in this state, and in most, they're not sympathetic to Republican candidates. They weren't terribly sympathetic to me. Not all the time, anyway. I'm going to tell you that we shouldn't be patient. We need to get out and work. We need to start grooming young, good candidates. And we need to start grooming them from the Latino community, the Asian community. There are bright young kids who think as we do, and we need to do something that gives them a chance. Reapportionment is key. I mean, one of the things that we did early on, I was telling my lunchmates that I had a little fun with Willie Brown. After he had become mayor of San Francisco, I said, "Willie, have you ever considered how much you owe me?" And he said, "What in the hell do I know owe you?" And I said, "Listen, if it weren't for term limits and reapportionment reform, you'd still be here instead of having this cushy job as mayor." There is something to that, I can assure you. And a fair reapportionment would produce what it did when we got it. I think the first fair and honest reapportionment probably in the state's history. We went to court. I vetoed three of Willie's gerrymanders. And we went to court, got original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court, and I then appointed a 6-member commission, 3 Democrats, 3 Republicans. And the Democrats, well, both and Republicans, 4 of the 6 were retired appellate court justices. One was Jack Arguelles, Supreme Court. The 2 non-judges, one was Dutch Higgs from San Diego, the first state bar president from San Diego County and a twice chairman of the Board of Regents of the UC system. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember Dutch. He looked and sounded like Abe Lincoln. He was a Democrat, a conservative Democrat. And the remaining non-lawyer, the only non-lawyer on the 6-person commission, was Condi Rice, then provost of Stanford. And I gave them one instruction. I said, "You're going to have to follow the requirements of the Constitution, the state Constitution, the federal Constitution, but you could still do a gerrymander doing those things. But what I want is a fair and honest reapportionment." because if we get one, it'll make a hell of a difference. You know, it did. We went from a congressional delegation of 30 Democrats, 20 Republicans after the reapportionment, the first election after the reapportionment, 25-25. And it was in time to help Gingrich become the first Republican speaker in 50 years. And it allowed me, as governor, to have a one-vote majority in one house of the legislature, in the assembly, the first time that had happened since Ronald Reagan was governor. And I will tell you, it made a difference. In fact, I said to Kurt Pringle, who was finally the speaker, by the way, we had to clean house, literally. We had to get rid of three turncoat Republicans in the first year. So we only had 1 year, one vote, one house, 1 year. In that year, I vetoed only one-third of the bills that I vetoed in every other year of the seven. In fact, I said to Speaker Pringle, I said, you did a terrific job of killing the bad bills in committee. In fact, the only bad bills I got were yours. I was just kidding. Yes, ma'am.
Last question.
You mean the top two? I'm inclined to agree with you. The rationale for it was that in hopeless Democratic districts, you would give the Republican voters the opportunity to vote for the lesser of the evils. And instead of a total leftist who was beyond hope, someone who was more moderate at least would reduce the number of Democrats willing to keep loading up the statute books and, worse, the regulations that make this state so unattractive to business. I take it that you're opposed to it. Wisely so. I think it was a mistake. Raise hell with someone. Someone in office. Thank you.
Please thank Governor Wilson.